This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I have the very great pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Brooke Larson about her book titled The Lettered Indian: Race, Nation, and Indigenous Education in 20th Century Bolivia, published by Duke University Press. This book does a whole bunch of things that I think are incredibly interesting, focusing on the literal rural school in Bolivia, as well as the concept and the debates and the politics around schools in rural areas. The book helps us think and rethink about the politics of race, indigeneity, nation, empire in Bolivia, really through the whole 20th century and in many ways kind of up to the present. So Brooke, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast to tell us about the book.
Thank you, Miranda. I'm so delighted to be here.
We are delighted to have you and would love if you could start us off, please, by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book.
Well, I have been working on Bolivia, on one aspect of its history or another, for most of my career, going back into the, I hate to say it, 1970s when I was a graduate student. And I was initially attracted to Bolivia because, first of all, it seemed like an intellectual and personal adventure to be there. Hardly any American researchers were working there in the 1970s, except for a few anthropologists, many of them from France and England, several of them. So for personal reasons, it seemed like a wonderful way to get ensconced in a field that was still really just being discovered by researchers both at home in Bolivia and abroad. And for intellectual reasons, I was drawn to Bolivia because I discovered as a graduate student the spectacular historical significance of the silver mines of Potosí during the colonial period. And very little had been written about it. And I realized that the silver coming out of the southern Andes was based on indigenous labor, the descendants of the Incas and even older Aymara culture on the one hand. And that silver being extracted from the mines of Potosí was flowing outward, most of it was in any case, flowing outward and beginning to help to finance Europe's overseas expansion, not to mention finance Spain's imperial wars, both on the continent of Europe and overseas as well, and of course to finance its growing imperial empire in the Americas. So for all those reasons, I was drawn to Bolivia, and my first book was actually, well, the MA thesis was on Potosí, but from there I branched out, and my first book was on the impact of colonialism and agrarian transformation in the shadow of the silver mines of Potosí, and that book came out in two editions in 1988 with Princeton and again in 1998 with Duke in a new edition. And from there, my work on the Andes sort of broadened out, and I got involved in very interested in the post-colonial period in the 19th century. And I was drawn to both Bolivia, but also Bolivia in the context of the greater Andean region, that is to say, made up of countries emerging in the early 19th century from Colombia and Ecuador down through Peru and Bolivia. Because these were regions, sort of proto-nations or would-be nations, aspiring nations, that faced not only the usual problems of trying to set up viable political governments in the wake of devastating independence wars, but these were countries that faced large populations of indigenous peoples who had served as the degraded labor force under three centuries of colonialism. So they face formidable social, political, ethical issues of nation making as they confronted this particular legacy of colonialism, that is to say, large indigenous populations that remained largely outside the framework of modern national communities. Mm-hmm. And Bolivia, again, was an amazing case study of that. So that book called Trials of Nation Making came out in the early in 2004, an earlier edition came out in Peru in 2002. And since then, I've been moving up into the 20th century. So as I've told a couple of colleagues recently, I guess this is probably the last big historical project that I will embark on, because the 21st century is really a century for the contemporary political scientists and sociologists. Too soon to do history of the 21st century. So this book is, in a way, in many ways, a continuation of my book on the 19th century, because I'm looking at the continuing problems and challenges of nation building. But rather than my scope being large and broad across the four Andean nations, I've gone back to do an in-depth study of these same problems in the case of Bolivia.
Mm. That's an incredibly helpful foundation for our conversation. So thank you for starting us off with that. It really kind of gives us a lot of context for the discussion. And specifically within that frame of nation building that you talk about really right from the beginning of the book, it's a deep dive in Bolivia, but it's also a deep dive in kind of one particular piece of the nation building, or at least that's how it's framed early on in the 20th century. Can you tell us what the, quote, Indian education problem was for Bolivian leaders right at the beginning of the 20th century, and how they initially debated and thought about trying to, quote, solve it?
Quote, solve it is right. In fact, quote, Indian problem is, of course, a colonialist trope that comes down to us from, well, North America. But so we have to, in a way, unpack the idea of the Indian education problem just a little bit, because the object, as you suggested, was the so-called Indian problem itself. And that, of course, I've already referred to, and when I was talking about my earlier book on nation building. In Bolivia, the Indian problem is acute in that Bolivia is probably the most indigenous population, the most indigenous country in South America, proportionally speaking. And so as a group of liberal nation builders began to encounter and diagnose this so-called Indian problem, they did so through their writings, through their so-called their scientific diagnostics, using pseudoscience, race science, often evolutionary theories, etc., on the one hand, and literary essays and all kinds of treatises and manifestos about what is the nature of the Indian problem and how do we go about solving it. So this was a new field called indigenismo, new in the very late 19th century, early 20th century. And eventually, this group of indigenista state builders and philosophers and scientists began to realize that the indigenous problem in Bolivia could not be solved through racial assimilation or extermination. And indeed, they even spoke in those terms as they compared Bolivia, the dilemma of having such a large indigenous population to contend with, as they compared their situation to, let's say, North America, where they looked and said, well, they're sustaining wars against their indigenous population out in the West, in the frontier. But we can't do that. We don't have the capacity. And in any event, they began to realize that the indigenous population had always sustained the economy through forced labor services and semi-feudal types of estates, haciendas. It was the indigenous labor force that was absolutely indispensable for the Bolivian economy to subsist. And so then what is the answer? Well, the answer to the so-called Indian problem becomes a question of social policy. And in particular, the idea that Indians should be civilized and to some degree assimilated into the Bolivian society and economy and nation through basic policy tools and institutions. And of course, education rises to the surface as the best, perhaps the only viable way to begin to bring the Indians out of their, coax them and coerce them out of their so-called primitive cultural lifestyles, lifeways, in isolation of the nation, and to bring them into the nation as a labor force, as a modern labor force, an efficient labor force, but still anchored to the countryside, still anchored on the land, because one of the things that they feared, and therefore this was part of the great debate among conservatives and liberals and all manner of indigenistas, was that education had to be specially tailored to the cultural characteristics of the Indian population, and that population had to be broken down, studied, diagnosed, etc. So that was a new form of scientific, pseudoscientific research going on at the same time. And at the same time as the indigenous population had to be educated in special schools to anchor them on the land and raise them up into a modern workforce, they had to be assimilated, civilized, taught to speak Spanish, perhaps even to read Spanish in a kind of perfunctory or rudimentary way, and to serve the nation as soldiers, as laborers, as patriots. And so the Indian education problem then becomes, how do we do this? How can we solve the Indian problem without bringing the Indians fully as equal citizens into the nation, without giving them too much power to use their new learning, their new skills, their literacy, for example, Spanish literacy, to make mischief, to even begin to vote? Because the idea was, we need to educate the Indians, but only partially. Mm-hmm. And only in a very limited way, so that they continue to serve as our labor force, and we do not disturb the caste hierarchy, the racial caste hierarchy that continued to prevail in Bolivia at that time.
All right. Well, that's obviously not exactly the easiest task that they set themselves, even putting aside how we probably think of most, if not all, of the assumptions that they were making to get there. How did the indigenous communities respond to these government plans to educate to some degree, but not others, and in specific ways?
Well, that's an interesting question, because it's not really just simply indigenous response. What I do in the second chapter of this book is I really pivot away from the urban elites and all these, you know, these agonizing debates and policy reforms that they're trying to initiate, to turn to the indigenous population. And in this case, it's very important to specify, I'm looking at the Altiplano and I'm looking at Aymara peoples who populated the Altiplano in mostly community, freeholding communities, many of them anyway, in freeholding communities, because they themselves began to initiate their own struggles and campaigns, including petition campaigns for rural schools. Not so much in response, although certainly there was some hope there as they began to realize that the elites were interested in beginning to implant rural schools hither and yon. Mostly it was on paper, not in reality. but rather they were driven by their own increasingly desperate measure to master the rudiments of literacy so as to begin to defend their legal rights to communal lands. Because on the Altiplano, at this time in the early 1900s, just as the Indian problem was being debated from above, from below, it was the land problem. And the land problem was coming into play because of the liberal land reforms in the late 19th century that were really beginning to take effect. As the land market boomed and elites were starting to land grab to take advantage of that 1874 liberal land reform of divestiture to seize lands and begin to turn them into great estates. And so it was this this moment of agrarian crisis and mass land alienation, or at least the threat of land theft as indigenous people saw it, that drove Aymara people, particularly those who had most at stake in protecting their communal lands, also called Ayu lands, that drove them to seek legal redress, to defend themselves in the courts. And in order to do that, of course, it entails a lot of skills in working with the documents, because the way they had to protect their lands was to litigate their original land titles. This gets a little involved in the kind of legal ins and outs of this period, but basically they wanted to exploit a legal loophole that allowed them to litigate their lands, to protect their lands under a clause of an 1883 law that said that if they could prove their ancestors had obtained original Spanish land title deeds, if they could prove that in the courts, they would have a chance to reclaim or to protect and defend their communal landholdings against the Hacienda regime. And so that's what drove them to search high and low for their own documents, often in archives, to litigate them in courts, and to develop their skills, their intercultural, interlinguistic skills to carry this legal campaign out. And literacy then, of course, becomes incredibly valuable, both symbolically and tactically, as a skill, as a tool, as an instrument that they had to be able to wield in order to carry out this campaign.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
All right. So with those two groups, if we're going to generalize them relatively, but you've outlined for us kind of two very different goals here, that I suppose in one version of what happens next, they could kind of talk past each other. And they don't, I suppose, inevitably have to get intertwined. But you talk about in the book that these issues around land and around of kind of education to a degree, in fact, become, quote, inextricable. And are very much intertwined going forward. So can you kind of connect these two up for us? How do they become so intertwined with each other and escalate?
Well, as the literacy of indigenous people or their struggle for lands becomes increasingly important, so too does the rural school become an object of great collective demand and desire. The currency of schooling in indigenous society begins to increase. And so you see, it's almost logical that an But you see it really on the ground where Indigenous people begin to both mobilize communities to build their own schools in the void, because there are very few rural schools in existence in the first place. Certainly no, very few public rural schools, primary schools. So they're looking to create their own schools out of their own resources in their own local villages, these freestanding schools. This happens more in the communities rather than haciendas, for obvious reasons. The landlord would not tolerate such a thing. And the other thing they do is begin to organize mass petitions. And those petitions do connect to this other group, the liberal elites who have been just talking about and debating the question of Indian schooling, of Indian education. So that, in a way, opens up a small possibility that Indigenous communities could begin to appeal to the new, more progressive, if you will, pro-school Indian, pro-school policymakers and intellectuals who are advocating for this. But basically, this is a movement that it takes place apart from state policy, because there is very little budget. The schools after the first 20 years are still, rural schools are still very scarce, and the resources really are not coming down from on high. And so Indigenous people begin to talk about building their own sort of schools with their own resources, and they do so, and they do so often in secret, if you will. They think of their own schools as contraband schools. That's the word they use. And rural teachers are often Indigenous people who have one way or another gained access to literacy. They speak Spanish. They can even write Spanish. And these are schools that are seen as and organized as alphabet schools. That's what they're called. They're basic sites where a rural school teacher would come in, or an Indigenous person who had gone off, let's say, and had to do 2 years of military service and has come back with a rudimentary knowledge of Spanish reading and writing. And so that's how it really begins. And what I've tried to do is show how this is a semi-autonomous movement, basically, of rural school building among Indigenous people. And that it's done often at great risk to themselves, particularly the Indigenous leaders, the caciques, apoderados, who petition for schools, but others are rural teachers who come in and set schools up. These schools are often targets of violence, landlord violence, violence of provincials, authorities. Many landlords forbid literacy instruction from happening on their own estates. They destroy the schools that might be, you know, in the process of being built, etc. So it's a very treacherous sort of movement that's flourishing, but also very fragile.
Thank you for painting that picture for us, both in terms of kind of the goals, but also the realities of trying to make them happen. Is this the context that we should start talking about the, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Wari Sata School?
Yes, this is the context.
Perfect. So what's the promise of it, kind of given the goals that you've just outlined and what's sort of happening? Why is this school kind of, given that there's multiple alphabet schools happening, you know, what's special about this one, and why doesn't it last?
Well, this isn't an alphabet school. The alphabet schools are, as I say, these fragile sort of independent schools, popping up in some villages throughout the Altiplano. This school is unique, and in fact, it's a sort of iconic landmark in Bolivian nationalist narratives to this day, although it wasn't always, but in recent years, it's been sort of rescued and rediscovered as a unique experiment in intercultural school collaboration. And it is really quite apart from and special unto itself. It begins in the early 1930s. What I'm arguing here in this book is that really the groundwork was laid in the earlier period with this Aymara school movement for literacy in schools that really created a network of indigenous people, caciques and other people who were part of this movement, this broader movement for the education of the Indian. But in this particular case, Wadi Sata emerges as a very special school that's the first school to be established through intercultural collaboration. It comes about thanks to the partnership of a distinguished, or well, he will become distinguished, a young school educator named Elizardo Perez, who's trained in the Normal School, and he is determined to do something different and to try to create an indigenous school that is uncorrupted by urban values and that is stands free of the persecution by landlords, et cetera, et cetera. But he has to do so in collaboration with indigenous people, local leaders, rural school teachers, possibly, because to impose his own ideas and values on an indigenous community would be, you know, not really what he's looking for in terms of generating a space for a genuinely indigenous school promoting the values of without violating the values of indigenous culture and et cetera. So he comes together with a rural school teacher named Avelino Signani. In 1931, it's almost a serendipitous encounter, but together they begin to draw up plans and stake out a site for an indigenous school that would become a community-based school that would teach reading and writing and also modern sort of agricultural skills and workshop artisan skills and things like that. But it would also be very much grounded in the values and customs and patterns of indigenous life that continue to exist in this area of the Altiplano in a place called Wadi Sata. And that's where the name comes from. It comes from the place itself. So this is an incredible experiment because it creates a space within which indigenous people, in collaboration with Perez and a few other white criollo teachers who eventually arrive, but basically it's built by the community using communal forms of labor and labor sharing sort of institutions, where they erect their own physical buildings, gardens, orchards, workshops, etc. And they, this indigenous group creates their own institutions of self-governance, a Parlamento de Amautas, it was called, or a Council of the Elders, who really was a decision-making body and a a site of governance, of collective self-governance in conjunction with peasant assemblies that would be gathered every so often to construct this school, to devise the rules, to create its own judicial system, its own tribunal where justice was performed. It's in that sense an extraordinary experiment in a school that was grounded in indigenous autonomy, indigenous ideals of self-determination, but also a school that was designed to empower and also to create a source, a space for the liberation of indigenous people, not just the students at the school, but the surrounding communities that were swept into the influence of Warisata as it expanded its radius of operation and influence throughout this whole region. And it flourished for about a decade.
And then what?
Yeah, well, that's the problem.
Because the picture you've painted so far sounds amazing,
fantastic.
Right?
Yeah, right.
But it lasts, as you said, for about a decade. So what happens at the end of the decade?
Well, think about it. If this is supposed to be a school of Indian liberation, in a society that's still fundamentally neocolonial, it's going to threaten. It's going to absolutely threaten the status quo in so many different ways. And that's why little by little, as it got started, Warisata became the object of a lot of violence of all kinds. But mostly attacks, both in on the ground and in the newspaper, et cetera, as a nest of subversive communists. That was the accusation towards the white teachers who were there, and a group of insurgent Indian Aymara Indians who were out to really raise, problems, to raise trouble. So what happens? Well, little by little, this is the Escuela IU, as it was called, as I say, comes under siege by surrounding landlords, haciendas, judges, and provincial authorities in the town of Achacachi. So it's constantly trying to shore up its protective forces against this these threats. But in the end, what really destroys it, or dooms it, I guess I could say, are two things. One is that the original founder, the white founder, Perez, the educator, leaves the site of Warisata. And he joins the government in 1937 of populists, of military populists, who like the idea of Indian education. And they are hoping that Perez will turn Warisata into, instead of a school of Indian liberation, school of economic development, a regional development. And he sent off across Bolivia to set up other little Warisatas, but not in the original mold, but rather in the new mold of Warisata as Indian schools, as enclaves of regional development and workforce development of Indians. So he's out of the picture. And that makes the original Warisata school far more vulnerable to this constant barrage of local attacks. But the second thing that happens at the top of the government, and that is the demise of the military populist government of Herman Bush in 1939-1940, and the coming back into power of a conservative oligarchy. that is absolutely against the very idea of the original Warisata as a liberation, a school of Indian liberation, of emancipation, and all the ideals that it stood for. And so there is a concerted campaign in the early 1940s led by a leading educator under the new oligarchic government to destroy, to dismantle, really, the IU school of Warisata, and to impose a strict sort of bureaucratic centralization on rural education, and to take away the idea that indigenous schools should be anchored in rural communities, drawing upon their own cultural mores and values, and rather turn it into a sort of agrarian schools that would assimilate Indians and turn them into good farming, farm hands. In a way, in the 1930s, 1940s, conservative reaction goes back to the early 1900s and the civilizing project of that very first generation of educational reformers that we were talking about before.
Mm. Yeah, no, it does sound incredibly similar to be going back to at this point. Sadly, obviously, Warisata at this point is no longer still going. But can you move us sort of from the early 1940s to the kind of post-World War II era? Do we still see legacies of Warisata at this point, even if we move beyond education to look at Indigenous activism more broadly?
Well, yes. There are two things here. One is right after the post-Chaco War era of the 1940s, late 1930s and 1940s. And that the war, together with the destruction of Warisata, in a way radicalizes the rural movements that had been struggling for schools, and really creates the conditions for a far more militant peasant movement based on a sort of class politics and coalitional strategies, where they're really starting to think about not so much schools per se, but agrarian reform, much more radical agrarian reform, as well as coalitions with rural sindicatos and other unions in the mines and in the militant tin mine unions, etc. So this is a much broader class movement that comes about in the early 1940s, and it engenders its own logic and forms of popular education outside the framework of the formal school, but within the movement itself. And that becomes a very interesting part, where these sort of professional agrarian peasant organizers, they're called dirigentes rurales or dirigentes campesinos, peasant leaders, really are organizing a broad-based interregional movement of both Quechua and Aymara-speaking peasants to rise up against the oppression of the hacienda and the racial oppression, neo-colonial oppression that has kept them in place for so long, in subaltern place for so long. So this is a group that I look at this sort of movement as in a way, a space for spontaneous, improvised forms of popular education, dissident literature being produced and circulated and deciphered and acted upon as we see a peasant movement arising in the first half of the 1940s. Is this a direct outcome of Warisata? No, not really. It's in a way filling the void left by the destruction of Warisata in some ways. And in other ways, it's in a way taking a lesson from the limits and destruction of Warisata by pushing the indigenous movement in new directions towards more radical strategies and aspirations for sort of revolutionary reform that would overthrow the whole system of neocolonial rule that had been prevailing up until then and continued to prevail until the early 1950s.
So that gives a lot of kind of ideas of what the actors are and what their goals are at this point and how that's evolved. Let's complicate things, shall we? There's not already kind of many things going on here. The US gets involved. Why? Why does the US get involved in debates about Bolivian education kind of in its most narrowest form and a lot of these related elements? How is the US involved? Can you help us understand the appearance of this actor?
Well, you're right. It does get more complicated. And in fact, during the course of my research, I hadn't expected this. And this, I kind of stumbled upon this, as one always does in these research projects. And I was really surprised because it hasn't really been talked about much. We do know that, of course, the United States is getting more deeply involved during the war because the United States, deeply involved in Bolivia, I should say, because the United States had great interest in the tin industry during the war. But after the war, during the early Cold War, the U.S. priorities shift. And of course, across Latin America, it's increasingly worried. The United States is increasingly worried about the rise of radical nationalism and communism and socialism and anarchism, all the isms on the left that were now suddenly being flagged as part of the Soviet expansion in one way or another, indirectly, of course. So that's not the immediate motive, though. I mean, the United States gets involved partly because Bolivia, along with many other countries in Latin America, become the object of basically social reform and post-war bilateral policies of cooperation and diplomacy. So in the Truman period in 1947, there is, the Marshall Plan is going on overseas in Europe, but in Latin America, there are a number of bilateral cooperative services being established. The idea being that the United States has to sort of preempt the shift towards leftist communist ideologies in places like Bolivia by getting in there and establishing its quiet cultural diplomacy and through these cooperative programs in public health, in agricultural development, in road building, and in education in particular. So I'm looking at the cooperative programs that crop up in the second half of the 1940s that target Bolivia, and in particular, the Bolivian Indian. The idea being in Washington that it's sort of a discovery that unfolds during the Second World War, that the problem of the volatile mine workers in the tin mines, which so worried Washington since we needed the tin, was really connected to the Indian because, of course, the United States began to realize that the mining proletariat was indigenous in its origins and cultural roots. And so the Indian problem begins to move onto the radar of the State Department, the Bolivian Indian problem in particular. And so after the war, there is a great interest in Washington to target Bolivia's rural population to try to improve its living conditions, influence its ideas and loyalties, and experiment with its own programs of rural extension education, meaning that the United States would penetrate deeply into rural Bolivia, establishing schools and agricultural development stations. And also at the level of administration and pedagogy to reorganize Bolivia's program of rural education, since it was still in such a shambles. And so that's what the United States begins to look at. What it does is it discovers, in a way, the remnants of Warisate's so-called núcleos escolares. Those were spatial configurations of schooling in that Warisate had invented, really, back in the 30s, for the diffusion of its values and forms of organization to create larger spaces of indigenous emancipatory schooling. When the United States program comes into Bolivia in 1946-47, it doesn't really know the actors, the U.S. policymakers aren't really familiar with the history of Warisate, but what they do see is that there are these units, these remnants of the Warisate escuelas escolares that had cropped up in different regions across the country right towards the end of the 1930s. And they still existed, at least on paper. So the United States moves in and says, geez, this is a pretty good system. It has a central school surrounded by these dependent primary schools. And it's a way to think about how to administer these rural communities through a very efficient way of setting up a central school that's an agro-industrial center for training, and then to spread out, to diffuse the influence, the teachers, school-trained teachers, and school supplies through the central school. So it sees it almost like a school district and sort of totally turns around the original purpose and meaning of the Warisate Escuela Escolar into a point of diffusion for the skills and the values of North America into outlying school districts.
Hmm. All right. So definitely an interesting kind of intervention or addition of a key actor. What then kind of progresses from this? You talk about, in some senses, there's promise around indigenous education and empowerment. In some senses, potential that doesn't really get realized. I mean, kind of now that the stage is set in some senses post-war, what materializes in real life in terms of indigenous education and empowerment?
You mean during the 1940s, right? You're talking about still under the influence of North America?
Under the influence of North America, but if we also kind of continue that into the 50s as well, what do we start to see?
Well, of course, that's going to change everything. The influence of CIDE, that's the acronym of the United States' program in rural education in Bolivia. The influence of CIDE prevails throughout the 1940s and into the early 1950s, but it's really superseded by the great insurrectionary movement of the revolutionary national movement of the led by the MNR, the Movimiento Nacional Revolucionario, in 1952.
Well, let's go there.
Yeah, that really becomes a great. That's in a way the culminating moment of this half century of struggle and negotiation over rural schools. So the revolutionary movement has always been seen really as a break point in Bolivian history, a culminating moment when progressive coalition of forces comes into power, is able to break with the neocolonial past by granting universal suffrage for the first time, so that the 80% of the indigenous population, the adult population, regardless of whether it was literate or property holding or not, suddenly had suffrage, were enfranchised. Secondly, a massive agrarian reform with the breakup of the hacienda. So that is going to be absolutely crucial to the realignment of class power balances in the countryside. And then, of course, the nationalization of the tin mines. What's often forgotten in this historiography is the education side of it. And that becomes the fourth crucial reform coming about in 1955, 1956, where there really is a concerted effort for the first time on the part of the government to bring the promise of universal education in the old constitutions to reality and to begin to build or to help subsidize the rural building of schools in the countryside. CIDE is still operating. That is to say, the United States is still there on the scene, taking a low profile, actually, at this point, unlike its reaction to other revolutionary movements, obviously later in Cuba, but also before in Guatemala. Washington has a sort of wait and see stance, takes a wait and see stance here. But certainly in terms of the educational reforms, it's coaxing Bolivia to continue to implement, to organize and implement educational reform in the countryside. But it's also influencing the MNR in terms of what should be taught, how the indigenous peasantry should be educated, etc. And in that case, really CIDE's influence, the United States' influence and its emphasis on rural development and assimilation gets very much adapted by the MNR in its own educational reform scheme that is formulated in 1955 and 1956. So two things come out of that in terms of the government reforms, education reforms. One thing is the new emphasis, as I said, in the curriculum on schooling Indians in modern farm techniques. And so what we see here is, once again, the replication of earlier scheme of rural education as being specifically tailored to the rural population in a kind of vocational way. Indians are to be educated, but also anchored on the land, not unleashed on the cities, and they are to be therefore schooled primarily in agricultural skills. That's the first thing. Second thing that drives this educational reform movement on the part of the government, that's also very much fomented by the United States, is the assimilationist project to bring Indians into the nation as non-Indians, basically, as in a way that would encourage them to shed their indigenous customs, their indigenous identity, their indigenous languages, etc., and to become modern campesinos, modern Spanish-speaking campesinos, members of a homogenizing mestizo national culture. And those are the two goals that really draw inspiration from the United States, but then are readapted and applied by the MNR government in through its 1955 education code.
Thank you for laying that out. As you said, things change rather a lot as we come into the 1950s. What were some of the activist responses on the indigenous side to this? And perhaps this is a moment to start talking about kind of relations or impacts of indigenous activism in Bolivia beyond the country's borders.
Well, yes, this is really a wonderful part of the story, I think, in this final chapter, because it you know, if you get away from the sort of more formal government-driven reform project that was going on, and look at what was happening in the countryside, it's an extraordinary moment of cultural, political effervescence. The insurrection of 52, in a way, cracks open this this very oppressive agrarian society that had constrained and persecuted indigenous initiatives in the area of schooling. The agrarian reform itself, the breakup of the haciendas, the weakening of the landed oligarchy, all opens up spaces for indigenous initiatives to flower, and they do. And you see the spread of schools even before the MNR gets involved in financing and or not rural school development. At the grassroots level, there's an extraordinary outpouring of indigenous activism activity. And a lot of it is manifested in mass petitions. And here we see really how the, you know, changes at the top in the political sphere open up possibilities for indigenous activism to flourish and pressures to grow from the countryside. And so there's, in a way, a real renaissance of school building that's going on here that is located in the villages themselves and in those areas, especially where the haciendas are being broken up, land is being distributed, unions are being created, and schools are being built. And that's really unprecedented in scope and intensity in this whole half century of history.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Given that you've kind of taken us up to this point, it really does help us understand kind of just how big a deal this was. And not just in rural Bolivia. Can you maybe speak to how other people, especially other indigenous actors or kind of, I guess, non-state actors outside of Bolivia watched all of this and what they thought?
Well, that's an interesting question that I have to still work out, to tell you the truth, Miranda. I think, you know, immediate impact, let's say, in the 1950s. Mostly what we know is the way in which other nations were, you know, watching, other governments were watching what was the unfolding in Bolivia. You know, the fact that this was I have to back up and say, you know, the education side of the revolution has not been studied very well. And so in a way, what I'm finding is not well known, at least in certain ways, as to the scope and intensity of this, this grassroots movement. If we look beyond this moment, I mean, Cuba is right down the road, of course, in 1959. So there, you'd think that there would have been some interest in the Bolivian educational movement, both from below and from above. But to some degree, I don't think there was that much connection. Cuba went off on its own. It had a socialist sort of agenda from almost the very beginning, and by 1961 it had organized the literacy brigades and was doing an extraordinary sort of achieved an extraordinary victory over illiteracy, the rates of illiteracy in that society. Bolivia never managed to do that. On the other hand, I think that indigenous movements everywhere must have been watching and waiting and perhaps learning from Bolivia, but to some degree, that's still an area I would need to see. I'd need to follow that through.
Fascinating.
No. I mean, if we move up in time, if we move up in time, we can see that in the indigenous struggle for schools really begins to get mapped across Latin America with the indigenous rights movement. And that's in the 1980s. So we're taking a leap in time into the 1980s and certainly the 1990s, when we really begin to see a paradigm shift away from the assimilationist or developmentalist ideologies of Indian education into much more multicultural, bilingual, pluriethnic values that are shaping educational policy and thinking starting around the 1980s, starting in the late 1980s. Some of that has to do with the indigenous, primarily it has to do with the indigenous movements inside certain areas of Latin America, including Bolivia, by the way, because whatever was achieved in the 1950s, as I said before, you know, there was still the ideological rigidity that defined Indian education as something about something regarding in terms of assimilation and workforce development. So that's really not very far from the Warisata principles of emancipation. And it's certainly very far from the later principles of bilingual intercultural values that were beginning to shape indigenous educational movements at the end of the 20th century. But that's where we begin to see real cross-cultural transnational flows of ideas, influences, etc. That together with the sort of the rise of a new sort of liberatory notions of popular education coming out of the work of Paulo Freire and others who, working with peasants and laborers towards more emancipatory projects of empowerment. So I would say in both those cases, the late 60s, 70s, with the Paulo Freire movement for the pedagogy of the oppressed and all of that related stuff coming out of the leftist liberation theology sort of corner of things on the one hand, and 10 years later or 15 years later in the late 80s and early 90s, we see now a whole indigenous rights movement pushing countries to redefine themselves as multicultural. This is, of course, the neoliberal era, so it's a mixed bag, of course. But at least in educational politics and policymaking, and philosophies or pedagogies, this is a real paradigm shift in Bolivia, elsewhere, and it's really cross-fertilized through the indigenous rights movement.
That's an incredibly helpful jump forward to help us understand how the threads develop. I know you said at the beginning that the 21st century is perhaps too soon to be within your purview. But before I ask you my final question, is there anything you'd like to say about kind of the current state of indigenous rights in Bolivia and the extent to which you think we're still in a hopeful moment?
I think we're back in a hopeful moment. We go in and out of hopeful moments. You know, there's nothing sustained here. Because even with the turn towards multiculturalism in the late 80s and 90s, the neoliberal experiment exploded around 1999, 2000, with the uprisings, a series of uprisings in Bolivia, indigenous and labor uprisings, new coalitions, etc. But out of that comes the landslide election of Evo Morales, as you know, the first indigenous president in Bolivia and indeed in South and Latin America. And all along, the movement that led to that political landslide election is was this indigenous rights movement really led by, I would say, the cutting edge was the Catarista movement. They called themselves on the Bolivian Altiplano of mostly Aymara speaking people. You could call them the generational heirs of the 1952 revolution that wanted to sort of push the direction of change towards a much more inclusive, pluri-ethnic sort of nation where languages, the diversity of indigenous languages would be respected. At the same time, universal rights to education would be honored. So that's going on. And then through all of that, there's really a new discourse of decolonizing education and what that means. And that's really carried forth at the state level once Evo Morales comes into power in 2005-2006. So what we begin to see is not just a grassroots movement with all kinds of connections, by the way, to other parts of Latin America. I'm thinking especially of Chiapas and that movement against pressures of assimilation and there are other connections in Peru, et cetera. But this movement for indigenous rights and rights to cultural heritage, identities, and languages really begin to become a driving principle of educational reform policies and debates in the 21st century. And it's going on to this day, the struggle to decolonize Bolivia's educational system is very much at the forefront of policy and discourse in the country today.
Wow. Well, thank you for taking us really from the kind of end of the 19th century all the way up to the present. I really only have one thing left to ask. This book is obviously out and people can go read it. Is there anything you might be working on now that it's done that you'd like to preview or highlight?
You know, to tell you the truth, the more I think about it, the more I need to work on getting this book out in Bolivia. And that not only, you know, obviously the translation and the publication, the republication there, but I want to be able to make it more accessible to students at the university level, especially to students in the Normal teacher training institutes there, to people who are still engaged in rural school teaching under often quite difficult, harsh conditions. In a way, they're my unsung heroes. And so if I can, in the next couple of years, get this material, the stories here and the analysis here, repackaged, as it were, and distributed and diffused, that would be a wonderful thing, I think. For me to be to occupy myself with for the next year or two. After that, yeah, there are a lot of topics that spin off of this that I would like to pursue. But I think that's a conversation for another day.
Fair enough. Well, best of luck with getting this book in front of more people in more ways. And of course, listeners who have been listening along and want to read more, all the detail in the book. It's titled, of course, The Lettered Indian, Race, Nation, and Indigenous Education in 20th Century Bolivia, published by Duke University Press. Brooke, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.